Thank you so much for coming tonight, and I'm delighted to have Mary Wyman with us. I met Mary about 14 years ago at a contemplative outreach event with Thomas Keating.
Oh,
and Mary found out that I was a centering prayer practitioner and recruited me to become a facilitator for contemplative outreach, and we became really good friends, and we've done a lot of retreats together. Mary was the regional coordinator for contemplative outreach for
3.5 years.
3.5 years. So she spent a lot of time with Father Keating and Snowmass, and I remember when she was getting ready to go on the Camino. And she hadn't been exercising. I was like,
oh,
Mary,
shame on you.
You're going to go on the Camino? And she was going to carry her own backpack and everything.
The short version.
And although she does live in San Francisco on the hills, so I know she's walked a lot of those hills, but she's an amazing human being, and I'm very blessed to have known her and delighted that she's here to share a story with us. It's really good.
Oh, great.
Well, my goodness, Amber, that's a little grander than I thought I would get as an introduction. Thank you very much.
Could you turn your microphone on?
I believe that it's already on.
Okay. All right.
Oh, there's a red light. Does that mean it?
Yes.
I can hear you. I mean, it's not even good.
It's not on mute. It's okay. Got it. Amber said we were on a lot of retreats together, and it's true, but we were also on some advances. And I think that being with Amber was a big influence in my life. After all, I come out of the Catholic tradition, although not necessarily a practicing one. And Amber was the first woman priest that I knew, and I was very happy to meet her and see how normal the women priests are. She was lovely. And thanks, Amber, anyway. Get myself going here. I'm really happy to be invited to speak here tonight as at your church. As we all enter the Lenten season, and it's this roughly 40 days and 40 nights that interested me, with Amber's selected Lenten theme of pilgrimage for you all. I'm struck by this 40, I guess I have been for many, many years, because in the Bible it seems to come up again and again. You know, there's the 40 days and 40 nights of the rainfall that was part of the great flood in Genesis. And wasn't it Elijah that walked 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Horeb? And didn't the Israelites wander about 40 years, and that's a lot of days and nights, to reach the promised land? And biblical examples have one more that's particularly interesting to me, and that is that Jesus went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, that's the story. We believe it. Yes, I love to think of Jesus walking off, probably alone, although we really don't know that, and searching the exterior of his parameter of living and searching deeply into the interior of who he was. That appeals to me very much. I like to think of Jesus participating in more silence, in more solitude, and even the privation of a pilgrimage away from his home area. And I think it's very fitting that at this parish, the Reverend Amber suggests that this Lent The theme is pilgrimage, not just pilgrimage for the very small group, and there are a number of you in here who are going to go on that, God willing, inshallah, that you are going on the pilgrimage to England. Not just for that select few, but also for every single person here in the parish to walk a pilgrimage of morning to night, whatever you do, whether you are retired, whether you are working, whatever you're doing, let us shift our minds to thinking that this period of Lent can really be a pilgrimage with Jesus to the Easter events. As you know, probably been to a lot of them, there are hundreds of quite famous pilgrimage places all over the world. And these are venerated by people for their sacred characteristics, for something that evolves out of their religion, are something that the peoples of that area perceive to be grounded in the divine. And I'm just going to mention a few of them here because it took me a long time to realize that there were pilgrimages that arose out of every great world religion and that exists. And so, for instance, in India, there's that 1,500-mile-long Ganges River, which where millions each year go to bathe as a part of a ritual bathing. And then there's the Golden Temple of Amritsar, and it has the most phenomenal statistic. The Golden Temple of Amritsar is for the Sikhs, their sacred pilgrimage, and the average daily visitation to the sacred temple is 50,000 visitors per day. Hard to wrap your head around such a figure as that, how that many people could crowd in and do whatever they wanted to do and crowd out. And then, of course, there's the in Kashmir, there's the Mata Devi Temple, visited by 8 million Hindus yearly. And the Bodhi Tree in India, visited by the Buddhists. Any of you been to Shikoku in Japan? It is a small island in the south, and it has 88 pilgrimage sites where virtually all Japanese who celebrate or partake in any kind of a religion, they try to go there. Some go many times because it is 800 miles snaking between these pilgrimage sites, and they want to visit every one. It's astounding. There's, of course, the Western Wailing Wall for the religious Jews. There's Mount Athos in Greece. There's Mount Kailash in Tibet. And, of course, there's the Seven Sacred Mountains in China. And I was on one of those sacred mountains quite a few years ago with my children in China, and my son, I was behind, walking behind them, and my son came running up to me and he said, "Amelia's been bitten by a big monkey." And when I got up to her, surely enough, she had a severe bite bleeding on this sacred mountain. And so now whenever anything is mentioned about pilgrims, she says, "I'll never make another pilgrimage to China." So, of course, there are the Legion pilgrimage sites all over the world in the Christian religion. Think of the cathedrals. Think of St. Peter's in Rome and Chartres in France and Canterbury in England and many other cathedrals and those sites as well. And then there is the remarkable basilica in Mexico City for Our Lady of Guadalupe. And that receives an extraordinary amount of pilgrims there, and Fatima, and on and on. There indeed is a phenomenon of pilgrimage that occurs in all of the great world religions. But tonight I'll tell you about, talking loud enough? Mm-hmm. Tonight I'll tell you about a walking pilgrimage that I made 10 years ago in the year 2010. I was 70 years old at the time, and it was this pilgrimage, of course, took place in Spain. I was headed, without almost even knowing why, I was headed to Spain to a path called the Camino, and the Camino led from France, where I started, across the Pyrenees, down to Pamplona, and over. I'll show you a map in a few minutes. It was 500 miles. I walked every step. I carried my backpack. I walked alone. And I'll tell you a bit more as the evening progresses about some of that folly, as many of my friends called it. It was not a folly, however. I would never say that it changed my life, that it was something that was just the most miraculous thing that ever happened to me. But there were many subtle changes in my body, in my head, most certainly changes that came to me in my heart. And I think it was an opener from that divider here between this and this. It was quite amazing how I felt an open heart, especially after this whole thing was over. Now, during the walk, I kept a detailed diary, a journal, if you will, and I wrote in it every night. And every night, I wrote a postcard to my 5-year-old granddaughter, who said when I left to her mother, "I'm never going to see Grandma again. She's just never going to come back." And I thought, that's kind of, I mean, I saw her all the time. She lives across the street from me. And so every night I wrote her a postcard, and I spent time seeking out the postcards that would somehow or other mirror pilgrims and places I was, so that she could get a little bit of an idea. And I wrote not childish, foolish things, but I wrote to her, "This is what I did today. This is how many kilometers I walked. Ask your mama about that. This is how many miles that was. This is where I stopped tonight. This is what I ate. And these are the people I saw and met." So without understanding that that journal and that nightly postcard would be very instrumental to how I would process this total trip in subsequent years, it was what I followed. And do you know, because I walked alone, I was able to do that every night. I know that every trip I take with my husband or with Amber or with any other friend or friends, I just get lost in the friendship of, I'm going to rest a while, it's dinner time, I'm so tired. And you know, the evening is gone without, well, with the exception of Amber, we always pray in the evening. Without that exception, I tended to that. It became like a discipline. It became a joy to me to catalog what I had seen and where I had gone, what was going on, especially to capture the miles. And at the same time, you know, that I'd walked that day, I had maps which showed precisely the kilometer between village and village and village, and I added it all up and captured it in that journal. I didn't know at the time that I did that, because I didn't see myself as a writer, that I would put those things into a book. And I wrote it initially for the little girl. I put every postcard picture in and everything I wrote to her. Then I put in the journal and the real things that had happened to me that day that were perhaps a little too adult for her. And then when all of that got, after a year at home, and those got word processed, they worked their way into my brain and my heart in a new way, and it just triggered. You might call them short stories, you might call them reflections, but it triggered the stories and the people and the feelings I had and the changes I had and the falls I had and the health and the food and everything that went on to me as a solo pilgrim. I couldn't have done that without those memories flooding to me from the careful look at the journal. And at the postcard, at the postcards. And you know, I'll tell you one little thing. I was 48 days on the trail. And what occurs to me is that when I got home, my granddaughter said, oh, I got a lot of postcards, Grandma. I said, okay, let's count them together. And it was about 35. But I had walked 48 days and sent 48 postcards. And over the next 3 months, every single bloody postcard arrived, some of them looking a little bedraggled, but I had everyone there. And oh, she was very thrilled to do it, and I was happy to have it too. So, I wrote this book. It's called Grandma's on the Camino. And the reason I'm showing it to you is not to sell you a copy, although I would not be averse to selling you a copy. But I'm telling you about it because I'm going to read from this book three or four times this evening. What I'm doing now is just, with notes, kind of extemporaneously talking to you, but I will read you some of the precise, intriguing things that happen. So, first of all, starting this thing out now with that lengthy beginning, what's the big deal about the Camino in Spain, this path? Well, it's been there since about the year 900, many hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's a fantastical tale, really. It stretches the imagination. It stretches the credulity of people when I will tell them this little story. It's about St. James, one of the 12 apostles of Christ. So Santiago is the Spanish word for St. James. And it became from just a little spot in a field on the map 900 years ago, 1,000 years ago, it became this pilgrimage center which has attracted millions of people over the past few hundred years. It's very popular. So, St. James was one of the 12 apostles of Christ, and it's generally believed that after the death of Christ, he assumed the role of a missionary. People went off in different directions. They had a story to tell, the story of Christ. And he went off to the Iberian Peninsula. He got himself through France from Jerusalem and through France and finally down on the Iberian Peninsula. And so that's one part of the story. That's kind of believable. But he was very unsuccessful. It's thought, although not proven, that he stayed about 4 years in Spain. And at the end of that time, he said, I've had it. I give up. I've got three followers, and I don't think they even know what I'm talking about. And I'm going back to Jerusalem. And he did. And those three people went with him. I think what a shock. And especially a shock for the St. James and those four people. Because when he returned to Jerusalem, Herod Agrippa, who wanted to settle an old score with St. James before he went, promptly beheaded him. That would seem to be the end of the story, right? At least the Spanish part of the story. Thus, St. James was really the first martyr. And there's not another word about St. James that anybody can drag up from any source until about the year 900. That's 860 years later. So here's where it really gets murky and fantastic. It's a folkloric kind of a tale that circulated through Europe that the bones of St. James, the Apostle of Christ, were found in a field buried in northern Spain. So people say, well, Jerusalem and northern Spain, and how did this happen, and how did they find the bones 900 years later? What's going on here? Well, an old hermit started the whole thing, and he said to the local country priest, you know, every night I see stars twinkling in the skies in a most unusual pattern, and they're concentrated over a field over by my hermitage. And the priest went and investigated, and who knows, it may have been the Pleiades, I don't think that's the right pronunciation, doing one of their yearly things over several nights. But the priest saw it, and he said, oh, this is incredible. And he went to talk to the bishop. And the bishop said, dig around over there, see what you can find. And, of course, they found these bones. How did they know it was St. James? This is 800 years later, but St. James it was. And on the very spot where the bones were dug up, there went a little church. And then there went a cathedral. And then there grew up a big town around it. And industry around it.
Pilgrims all over the world began to hear the bones of St. James.
And, of course, the church cooperated magnificently. Indulgences. I'll sell you an indulgence. I'll have all of your sins forgiven. And you could just see how that snowballed through the churches of England, France, Spain, on over through Rome. This was a very different time than the time of Christ, 1,000 years later. And the cathedral was built. And that's the same cathedral built in 900 that I wended my way through to and landed at. Those European Christians were really enthralled through the years about the promises made to them by the church. Most specifically, forgiveness of sins. Most specifically, cures for grave illnesses. Most specifically, answers to petitions that nobody could. And probably our, you know, one of your speakers a few weeks from now will delve a lot more into this. But it was really quite amazing how these pilgrims created an industry. How many of them paid other people to walk the Camino for them? How many of them died on the way? We're talking about a long time ago, and you can imagine disease, simple illness, colds, whatever. Ancient old people walking their way to Santiago and they fall off a cliff and they're goners. There were hospitals set up all along the way for these people. And I saw some of those old hospitals. Nowadays, I had to visit once an emergency ward. It wasn't an old hospital for pilgrims. It was an emergency ward for the people of that town that I was in. And I just marched in and had help from them. So people still get sick out there. Now, I want to tell you this mystique that I tell you about, that in many ways is hard to believe, was not something that I bought hook, line, and sinker. I was interested. I had come from a very religious family. I had a very religious education through 6 years of university, all with an emphasis on theology and so on and so forth. But it was an unknown urge, irresistible, that I would go walk this Camino. I could not articulate it to Amber, to my husband, to my family. Why do you want to go on the Camino? What are you doing, woman, going on the Camino and thinking you're going to do this by yourself? And I had hesitation. Now, I have also had people tell me, well, I think, don't you think it was kind of stupid to go when you didn't know why you were going? They didn't understand what I didn't understand, that I was going to do this, and I knew that there would be something important for me if I chose to do this. Certainly, I didn't go because I wanted to touch the reliquary that held St. James's bones. I did that. I don't know how much good that did me, but there was a lot of other things on that Camino that did me some serious good. Now, I'm going to show you a little map. I apologize for this map being so poor, but I couldn't find the big one I used years ago. Sorry. This is a map of Spain, and I don't imagine many of you can see this very well, but this is Iberia, Spain, and this is France. And this divider through here are the Pyrenees Mountains. And the path that I chose to walk went across the Pyrenees on a footpath, and it went from the French side to the past the marker, down the Spanish side of the Pyrenees to Pamplona, and then about 460 miles beyond that on walking trails. So that's where this Camino is. I mention that because I learned many things about the Camino over the years, and one of the things I learned was that there are Camino paths virtually all over Eastern Europe, Western Europe, England, Scandinavia, that lead, they are Caminos leading to Santiago de Compostela. The one I took happens to be, just by the by, probably the best known one. And it's 500 miles long, and it, I'll just read you a little bit about it here. The Camino paths today, all of them, carefully follow the paths that were set into motion some few hundred years ago. And they go right through farmers' farms, walked right through vineyards, walked through ancient dilapidated villages, walked through big cities, because that was the path of the ancient path. So these Caminos are mostly footpaths, as I say, through mountains, forests, vineyards, farms, and along the ruins of ancient Roman roads that followed the trade routes. The trails are really rocky and rutted. They have not repaved them for the tourists of today, for the pilgrims of today. I had to walk, as other pilgrims did, through three mountain ranges. I'm not talking about, peaky mountains that people spend years, but I'm talking about the mountains that roll and grow higher and higher and twist and turn and go over mountain ranges. Three of those. Also, there were cow paths. I walked on so many cow paths, sheep paths, goat paths. And, it's all scattered around you. And sometimes I met actual herds of sheep and goats and cows. There were farm machinery trails. And I describe, because I am a country girl, a farm from southern Illinois, and I was so drawn to the farming areas of Spain and to see the old men and women sitting on rocking chairs at farmhouses and seeing the extraordinary work and the equipment that the men and families were using out in the field. So different than my brother, for instance, in southern Illinois with all that modern John Deere stuff and big tractors and air-conditioned tractors and all of that. It was really fascinating for me to see Spain feed itself through that northern area. And on occasion, and to contrast with the isolated country trails where I walked, the Camino roads took me along old canals. They were built by the Romans. They were as old as could be. And I walked on them, big, uneven stones like this put together. And the amazing part was that the canals that the Romans built are used as irrigation canals today. And I saw men and some women working on just great wheels of things, controlling little irrigation trickles going out into the fields and into longer canals carrying the water many miles away. I had to cross many highways. I had to cross freeways. There was quite a lot of intermingling with automobiles. Although I don't want to overplay it, but at least every day I'd be walking on a road, usually two lanes, where cars would be coming up and down, and I had to be very careful. Every year, a half a dozen pilgrims are killed on the Camino, or they have a heart attack or something occur, bicycle accident or so on. So I really was very careful about it. There were many footbridges that were built for pilgrims. If a pilgrim path came through going over and it had to pass a major inter-country freeway, they built just incredible foot walkways to get us across them safely. I was very glad. Walked through many dozens of culverts built underground where they would be huge like this, and I would enter one and pray that there was no thief on the other end or that would come to me. And I would meet people sometimes in there. But those were pilgrim passages under some roads. There's a lot of big cities that I went through. Pamplona was one of them. And in Pamplona, I stayed at a very wonderful pilgrim place. It was a desanctified Jesuit church. And what they had done was so unique. When you walked in, you could see the stained glass windows. Everything had been taken out that were pews and altars and so on. And they had built a glass, I suppose plexiglass, floor all around that church so that the pilgrims who would go upstairs and sleep in the beds around there could all look at the stained glass windows, could see the downstairs, would like create a community. That was in Pamplona, very interesting. But then there were the cities of Puente de la Reina, Logroño, Santo Domingo, Burgos, names some of us hardly know, I hardly knew them, and yet they are big cities in northern Spain. Astorga, León, and then, of course, the Santiago itself, the site of the pilgrimage destination. I still puzzle with why I did this, with why I endured 48 straight days of walking. I was gripped by that idea for many years. I believe I mentioned that. But I kept that a secret. I didn't talk to my colleagues at Department of Labor, for instance, about my interest in the Camino. I didn't even talk with my family about it. But it just was nursing there as I thought about it. And every year I'd come across a book or two about the Camino and read it. There are some very famous ones. And I was pretty sure that it didn't have anything to do with directly religious. I came to believe that it was a very spiritual urging invitation that piqued my curiosity as to why I would do this walk. But certainly, it was not a motivation of guilt, so that I would hope to get forgiveness of sins when I got there. I'm sure I had some sins, but I certainly was not thinking of them as in connection with forgiveness that would be issued with certain criteria once I got to the place. And certainly, Amber sort of alluded to it, I'm not a sportswoman. I was not motivated by a very common motivation, and that is the current popularity for a physical long walk through. It wasn't part of a bucket list of walking. It was certainly not a cheap vacation I was looking for, because from what I knew, what I was getting into, I knew that it was going to be cheap, and I knew it was going to be primitive, to say the least. I wasn't either just an aging senior out for a fling, an adventure. It was burning. It was smoldering desire. And if I repeat that three or four times, it becomes a theme, I think. Why do I need to be there? So, one day in the fourth year after I retired, I've spent 3.5 years running this contemplative organization. I was upstairs at my desk, and in a single hour, this is exactly what happened, in a single hour, I came across two quotes in my general reading. And the first quote was a Kashmiri wisdom saying, "If not now, when?" And the second one was by Francis of Assisi, just an hour later, that said, "The journey is essential to the dream." And it just clicked. Right now, time to go. Time to do this. I went downstairs, electrified by this idea that the time had come, and I went to find my husband, Larry. And I want to read you just a little bit about that. Page 3. Because, you see, I had never talked to Larry about this. Oh, I wish he was here. He wanted to come so much tonight, but the asthma kicked in. Okay. 3 and 4, not 4 and 5. I approached my husband, Larry, running downstairs with my plan to go to Spain, and asked if he would like to accompany me walking the Camino. He was surprised, declined thoughtfully, and I suspect that he really understood me better than I did myself. "Mary, this is apparently a long-time idea you have nurtured, and it really sounds important the way you describe it. I encourage you to pursue this walking pilgrimage, but I don't want to be gone from home that long. It's going to be a couple of months. Who among our friends could you ask to accompany you?" So he started out with the idea that you got to have a partner. I fairly blurted out, "Absolutely no one but you, Larry, and thank you. Thank you for your encouragement. I will walk the Camino alone." And this exchange between us was kind of vintage, I would say. Larry opened to our personal freedom and growth and our, I guess you could call the marital ties, held together with a fluid tether of trust and love. And I quote in my book here, somewhat as Kahil Gibran would say, let there be spaces in your togetherness. So over the next few days, a plan emerged for Larry to accompany me to Spain for a vacation together before I started the Camino walk alone. This would prove to be of enormous assistance to orienting me to Spain. I don't know a word of Spanish. I didn't know what money they were using in Spain at the time. And I was going to be 2 months by myself. You know, I had to have access to money. I had to kind of know the ropes of how to get around and so on, besides walking. And I know that that really gave Larry confidence that I would be okay 2 months by myself, where I didn't speak any Spanish. My daughter Amelia and son Nathan were less sanguine about, but curious, interested, concerned, polite even, about this plan for their 70-year-old mother to walk alone. My close friends and extended family with whom I shared this proposed walking adventure, they were also curious. Many highly supportive, others barely polite. Pointing out every dire and extreme eventuality and suggesting that I could see just as much and go the 500 miles to Santiago by train or bus from the starting point of this little French village, Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, or as an alternative, some sniffed, why not take a nice escorted pilgrim tour with other seniors? And I responded with some close version of Sister Joan Chittister. Do you know who she is, the writer? And she quotes from a book called The Gift of Years for Seniors. And she says, old age is the time to be dangerous. Dangerously fun-loving, dangerously alive. This is the time to do every single thing we can possibly do with all the life we can bring to it. This is the time to live with an edge, with strength, with abandon. There is nothing for which to save our energy. Now it is simply time to spend time well. All right. It took 2 months to actually get on the plane and go. I selected the route and began to study about it, got a couple of books on it. It was called the Camino Francis. I told you, it was 500 miles away, long. And then I found as I was preparing that there were many practical things I had to become involved in, and very seriously. My preparation was minimal. I believe I heard that in here earlier this evening. Amber was one of those who was very worried about me, I think. Preparation was minimal because I was naive about the physical requirements. It was an idea. I will go out every morning. I will walk 10 miles. I will go out the next morning. I will walk 15 miles. All of this will just present itself. It will go hunky-dory. Okay, I was naive. Good shoes, I reckoned. And a backpack would pretty much do it. I didn't like the idea of walking poles, although the advice nurse at Kaiser Hospital in San Francisco backed me into a corner and she said, I'm proud of you, but don't go without walking poles for balance, for safety, etc. Didn't listen to her. And to prepare, I managed to walk about 3 miles a day for a month. I thought that would get me into shape. I was fairly naive. Now, when did I go? In the year 2010, I was going in the month of April, May, and early June. I figured it would take about 8 weeks. It took me 48 days. It was a period of time, I reasoned, not having any direct knowledge about it, that the weather would be good every step of the way. I mean, isn't April gorgeous everywhere? What about May? Oh, May, flowers and nature blooming. And the weather was very mixed for me. I don't regret it, but it was mixed. The first week it was gorgeous. The second and third week, out of Siberia came a killer storm that went all across Eastern Europe, and settled itself in the northern trails of the Camino in northern Spain. I had terribly cold weather. It was windy. There was rain. There was sleet. There was snow. And my last 3 weeks were very hot, going into June, and rainy. And I didn't have the right kind of clothes exactly. Although I made do, I didn't have a sleeping bag, for instance, which I needed every night. I didn't have a proper warm enough jacket, because after all, April, May, and June, why would you need a jacket? But I got through okay. It was just that I was often, if not always, dealing with the exigencies of weather. A choice that was very important for me to make and odd to other people was that I walked alone by choice. I was 70, as I've told you over and over. I had a lot to think about. I wasn't afraid for 1 minute to do this alone. I felt like a free spirit most of the time. Overall, I'm glad I walked alone without a companion. For what happened? I observed on the Camino, the companions were very high maintenance. Not to discourage the two of you who will be making a Camino. I'm happy that I walked alone, for I observed that companions were high maintenance. They were, a couple would pass me, five women or four men or whatever would pass me. They were always faster than I was on the little trails. And they were always talking and joking. And that was wonderful for them, but it wasn't anything I was interested in. They clustered together. They got lost from each other. Virtually everything had to be negotiated. It's a bit like marriage or any other complicated relationship. When should we leave? What should we eat? Where should we sleep? What to see? How far to walk today? I mean, there was, you understand that dynamic that they loved, but I did not. And although I was naive about my preparations, I knew that I wanted to walk in the deepest silence that I was able to collect around me, that I was able to walk into and walk through and come out the other side. I knew I had the kind of personality that would tolerate that silence. I wanted to observe and experience the Camino with really open eyes and an open heart. I wanted to process the experiences in private without constant commentary from a companion. I liked the pleasant rhythms of just my own footsteps, not a whole bunch of footsteps. Oh, I can see it myself. What time did we start? 6:30. 15. I'm telling you a lot of stuff that I didn't. That's just coming and bubbling up. I'm going to probably have to cut this short a bit, but I want to read you a couple of more things. Even though I walked alone, I wasn't walking with my head down, being all religious and, you know, poo-pooing other people and so on. I recall that walking alone gave me the most inordinate pleasure in the landscapes, which were fabulous, the flora of spring, the fauna of spring, the horses, the cows, the sheep, surrounding me everywhere as I went on paths. And I want to reread, I want to read you one reflection from my book about observing the birth of a baby goat on the Camino. It happened one morning in walking through very hilly countryside that I came down from a hill and I could hear little clicking, clucking noises that very soon I could tell were bells on goats, and that something was happening below me where my path was walking. And it took me a while to understand that there were several hundred goats gathered and all lying down. And now I'll just read what happened. Sheepdogs, maybe 8 or 10, were lying among the goats, several appearing to be asleep. I estimated about 300 in the herd. I noted a not unpleasant smell in the air, a bit like freshly opened ripe cheese. Filled with curiosity, I joined the group. I actually walked down in. There were goats on both sides of this path, and there were pilgrims standing on the path, maybe 5 or 10. I slipped my backpack to the ground, and then I sat down in the dirt to observe the event at eye level. Even in my calmness, my heart opened in complete wonder at the scene. I was fully aware that this was an unbidden privilege of observing birth on the Camino. Probably 15 minutes passed as a young female goat struggled to cooperate with contractions that caused her to kneel and to rock back and forth on her front and back legs. I sensed the birth would occur within minutes. A snippet of creation is groaning in one great act of giving birth. And as the struggle of the goat to give birth intensified, several pilgrims left the group. One or two took pictures, and I was left there. In a matter of a few seconds, and as a complete surprise to the remaining observers who were there, the goat dropped and knelt on its front knees, perhaps in adoration, and the torn sack shot onto the ground. And just as with the birth of my own two children, I watched breathless until the life force exerted itself with healthy crying and writhing. The new mama goat stood immediately and began to chew the sack open, freeing 4 long legs, a perfect little head and body. By the way, this was 10 feet from me. I sat down on the ground. The goat was as close as you are. The goats then, after a bit of conversation with the men, whistled for the dogs, and the entire bucolic scene erupted into action. This wasn't 10 minutes after the birth. The dogs began racing among the goats in their herding moves, following the whistling and hand movements of the men. The goats all scrambled to their feet and seemed to arrange themselves into a couple of dozen formations, almost single file. I couldn't understand. I didn't move from my position seated on the path, and at first all seemed chaotic, but the most amazing pattern began of planned action began to exert itself. Formation after formation of goats moved forward by the dogs and towards the new mother and baby. As the goats trotted by the baby, they gave a sniff and a nudge and then scampered up on the path behind me. The goats were being herded to greener pastures. I was weakened by my proximity at eye level to the passing hundreds of goats. I didn't know if they'd knock me over in a seated position, but they were just whew, whew, wave after wave going by me. And then not time to read the rest of it to you, but it entails a very endearing scene in which the man at the truck, when all the goats had left, another 10, 15 minutes, he walked over and he picked up the baby with the front and the back legs, holding two legs like this, and he marched himself off to his truck. Well, the mother goat just went crazy, went frantic, was just incredibly frightened. And I thought, I'm going to watch what happens here. And I followed him over right to his truck. And I know no Spanish, but he told me in Spanish, "Oh, I'm just taking them back to the barn." That's what I think he said. And he arranged the baby goat, and then with great effort he lifted that enormous just given birth mother up, and he actually positioned them into a nursing pair. I was enchanted. I was made very happy by that. And after it was all over and I fed crumbs from my sandwich to some very pretty blackbirds, complete happiness overtook me. I didn't have to understand what had just occurred with the goats. It was a treasure. It was just another day's event, another blessing on the Camino. That stuck with me for a long time, that situation. Now, I keep talking about walking alone, but it isn't to say that I didn't have extraordinary experiences with other pilgrims, with bicyclist pilgrims, with locals met along the path, with tourists driving their own autos who had no clue as to the purpose of pilgrimage. I would go into a bar, no scandal here, to get a coffee in the morning or in the afternoon, and there were inevitably people who had stopped at that same cafe, and they were really curious about the pilgrims. We were a pretty scruffy-looking lot, and I had several conversations with people to whom I was able to tell what we were doing. And one of the couples said to me, after I told them about St. James and all of that, they said, "You know, it's only," man says to his wife, "it's only about 350, 400 miles to Santiago. We don't really have to get to Madrid today. Let's drive to Santiago." And his wife said, "Oh, wonderful. I'll just call the hotel and cancel our reservation tonight." And when I went out with them to their car, the man turned and he said, "Oh, when you get to Santiago, will you pray for us?" They were from Arizona. And I said, "Oh, yes. When you get to Santiago this afternoon, you pray that I'll make it in about 2 weeks." Well, I know that the time is running short. Isn't that 5 to 8? Or is that
7:30?
So I'm through, right? Oh, what a shame. I could go on another hour, but I won't. But I will tell you that in my book, I tell extraordinary stories about other animals, other things that happened to me on the Camino. One of them was indeed frightening when, on a mountain path, hadn't seen anybody for 2 hours, I came on the path. I couldn't leave the path and go around it. I came upon griffon vultures feeding on a dead sheep. And griffon vultures, this is no exaggeration, have wingspans of 8 feet. They are enormous. And they're all over northern Spain. There's a lot of history about them, a lot of controversy about them. But they were eviscerating a sheep on the path. And I was in such close range that I watch an eye being plucked out of a head. I watch the eviscerated innards torn and pulled across the path until I could beat a hasty retreat. I also tell something that is so dear to me, And that is that in the months of spring, the storks come. They migrate from northern Africa to northern Spain. They're in several places in Spain, but that's the primary place. And through my whole walk, starting in April and ending in June, I saw every phase of that fabulous, fabulous stork phenomenon. I saw the building of nests. The nests are this high, they're this big around, they're built on year after year after year. They sit on the most precarious little perches that you think wouldn't begin to hold them, on peaks of steeples. It's and all over towns. And I watched the entire process until I said, I think there has to be babies being born now. And indeed, a week or so later, I began to see little heads peeking over the thing. So that was a very dear experience to me. And where I slept at night, albergues.
Go ahead with that, but talk about your fall.
I could do that. I had five falls on the Camino. And after the third fall, I bought poles. And from the instant I bought the poles, I was a new and different pilgrim. And I never, well, I had two more falls, but that was not because of my, I was solid on my feet. And I started out with a cheap backpack from Market Street in San Francisco. And on the fourth day, when I bought the poles, I bought a proper backpack that had support across here and support across here. And suddenly, the weight just seemed to disappear. I carried 18 pounds, 18 to 19 pounds. All right, Amber. All right.
I told you so.
You did. So on the Camino, I carried just two or three things. I carried a waist pack, and in it I had credit cards, cash, passport, a guidebook, the postcards that I'd have for my and stamps for, and a journal. And then, most importantly, I had a Camino credential. I'm getting to the falls, Amber. Every pilgrim, in order to get the cheap accommodations, pilgrim accommodations of a bunk bed with maybe 10 to 100 people in one room. Oh, this room would easily take 100 people as in an albergue. Every person had to have what they called a credential. I got mine officially, and the very first night I was out on the road, somebody stamped it and put the date underneath. And every one of these stamps on both sides represents the place I stayed along with and feel free to come up and take a look at it. It's quite fragile at this stage. There have been 1,000 people who have handled it just since I'm back home. I started my walk across the Pyrenees without poles and experienced three serious falls. Page 25. It isn't possible to explain just how or why I took two more unexpected falls that afternoon. The several mile descent into the town of Zubiri, my destination for the day, was steep, but the path was not unusually rocky. Now remember, I had no poles. Perhaps I was overconfident of my ability as a hiker. Perhaps I was preoccupied with the onslaught of blisters that soon into the trip, and preoccupied with the beautiful flowers and distant scenery. Perhaps I was unsteady on my feet caused by the backpack with the wobbly straps. And perhaps it was my stubborn resistance
to the advice of seasoned walkers to use hiking poles to steady and balance myself. Whatever the reason, each fall occurred as falls do, without warning, swiftly, silently, and spread over a period of several seconds. The first fall was the more serious. On a downward descent, I found myself sliding uncontrollably on gravel, then stumbling and lurching forward, nothing to hold on to, my arms flailing, my right foot plowed into an enormous boulder knee high, over which I flipped, coming down hard in an area off the path, hitting my elbow and my right shoulder on another rock outcropping. Eventually, all body parts and my belongings came to a full stop. The ugly noise of falling. Do any of you relate with the ugly noise of falling? The ugly noise of falling gave way to silence. I just lay there, surrendering into my totally contorted position. I knew I was conscious and sensed that I would not roll farther into a ravine just to my left. I felt no immediate pain, no sense of urgency or panic. I just lay there, relaxing muscles area by area until all was still, letting go, collecting my thoughts, accepting and yielding to the situation. Was anything broken? Ah, pain now. Right foot and leg okay, left foot okay. Same for the right and left arms. Blood on my cheek, pain welling up seriously now. But in spite of that predicament, I had to laugh out loud because in my flailing backwards, my backpack had been thrown over my head 5 feet farther down the trail. I guess it rolled a little bit. Collecting myself and getting on the path, I'll leave to your imagination. And I then, 2 hours later, had a second fall, which was a bit more serious. And it loosened the big toenail. You know, that's... I was difficult to ignore that little fellow, but I took a lot of ibuprofen with me. And now, I wish I could have told you everything, but it's time to go now, and it's time for me to stop, well past time for me to stop. But I can tell you that the idea of pilgrimage for this church seems so right to me. I am actually, based on talks with Amber and so on, I'm actually devoting my Lent to walking each day as a pilgrim. You don't have to go off to the other side of the world to be a pilgrim. You don't have to visit any shrine, say a lot of prayers, do this, do that, all kinds of ritual. You just walk every day. I sense that a number of you are retired in here. Oh, there are a bunch of you who are not retired yet, but there are a bunch of you who are. And you know, I shifted part of my whole thinking to elder life as being that people are pilgrims from birth till death. At whatever position you held in life, whatever your vocation was, you walked it every day. You may not have liked it. You may have had hard times. You may have had horrible times. But every day you walked it and you were the pilgrim on your vocation in life. And so that is why I think Amber's notion of considering this a pilgrimage period is especially, has an especial potential of spiritual growth for us during this 40 days. Because what are we doing? If we pay any attention to Lent at all, even 3 minutes a day or 5 minutes, or you have a reading, a Lenten reading as you go through, what we know is that you are walking with Jesus the Christ. through the days leading up to the Easter events, to the events surrounding the glorious Easter. And many of those events are not so glorious, but we are walking that pilgrimage too. Listen, thanks very much.
All right.
Anybody want a book? I'm okay to sell it. Got any elders at home who want to read it? I didn't bring my shell. Oh, shoot. I did bring my credential, though, that they gave me after picking up the fold-out thing. They went over every day. You know, I wasn't off in Paris for 2 weeks of the seven. And when they decided that was it, they gave me a very nice credential, which you can look at. Just come up and look.
Bona fide, huh?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
Take a look at it. And then just put it up there. You all can take a look at it. It's in Latin.
Well.
Do you have any other questions?
I do have a question. I've never walked more than probably 20 miles in a day, but I do a lot of cycling. And I know that when I would finish my cycling, I would pray for my feet.
Uh-huh.
And I just wondered if how you reflected at night. What you would say, I'm sure that you talked to God,
mm-hmm,
and asked for guidance and courage to continue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was not only courage from my brain, it was courage. Can I continue on these feet? I will tell you, I had blisters on between every toe, and I had a loose toenail that turned purple and stayed purple for a month until I got back to Kaiser over here. And experience, you asked, did I pray at night? Yes, I did. But I don't think you'll believe me when I tell you that where my feet were concerned, they were prayers of thankfulness. Not only that I could get back up on them every day, but I came to believe that because I had the foot injuries, that I would actually make it to Santiago. It slowed me down. It made me more reflective. I was grateful for it. And I had ibuprofen 600. Do you know how strong that stuff is? I have an arthritic right knee. And so in order to do anything, and I have for years and years and years, I take one ibuprofen 600 every morning with the doctor's blessing. And on the Camino, I took three every day.
Wow.
Morning, after lunch, and after dinner. Oh, I've got a whole section on this. A poor Amber's thing. And Mary, do not start talking about food. I'll tell you that I had my breakfast in a bar every morning, and the bars didn't open until 9 o'clock, and I had to be out by 7:30 or 8 from the albergues. They weren't going to let you hang around, and so I would walk. I would walk for an hour or so before breakfast, and I'd find a bar that was just opening up, and I would go in. I explain a lot about bar food in there and how they interacted with pilgrims and so on. And then for lunch, I'd eat tuna fish or something out of my backpack, a piece of fruit or so on. But in the evening, I had a pilgrim's menu. And you know that for well under $10, they were excellent. It wasn't just because I was hungry. Started off with the first course, went to a main course that included a salad. Every meal, the 48 days, had a lovely dessert. And every day, they delivered right to my table a half bottle of wine. And it was included in the price of under $10. And then I'll just, no day cost me more than 30, with the price of the room and a little of this and a little of that and my dinner in the evening. That was it.
Yes.
You mentioned that you didn't have a sleeping bag and you should have had a sleeping bag. So what did you use?
I bought something at Bed Bath & Beyond, which I thought would be the cat's meow to take with me. It was called a cabin cuddler. You put it down on the bare mattress, and then you climbed genteelly and easily on the bare mattress, and down below there was two flaps that covered your feet and two that covered your thing and two shorter ones that came around here. It was not enough in that cold weather. But it was enough. And, you know, it kept the bed bugs out and so on because there were never bedding. It was a bare mattress and a bare pillow. And I always put out one of my old shirts as my pillowcase every night. It's pretty primitive.
How heavy was that?
What was heavy was the little thing I put around me? Yeah. A few ounces. That's why I was so attracted to it. It just folded up into this little thing like this. And then at night I would unroll it. It was light, the kind of, little bit of wool in it or something. I don't know, like flannel. And then it just sort of unpacked itself and I popped it on the bed. Oh, and the snoring. Another night we'll talk about the snoring. Oh, my goodness. It was wonderful.
Tennis balls to stick on their bed.
Every person in there could have used it.
Oh, well, thank you, Mary.